I think Macron and Starmer and Meretz are all giving good testimony in the court of history for why rebellions are necessary from time to time inside its societies. Europe has not had a true rebellion or series of rebellions for a very, very long time. But I think it's getting to the point now where the people of Great Britain, France, and Germany are going to have to come to terms with the reality that to survive as nation states, to emerge from the terrible tragedies and crises that they've been being dragged into by these globalists, the people that are governing them will have to be forcibly removed. Because the parliamentary systems, though, in many ways are attractive because they're a little more flexible than what we have. In other words, you can still hold a vote of confidence and remove a prime minister and his government, and that's helpful, although recent legislation in Britain apparently makes that tougher right now. But we are more presidential system, much like Macron's system at this point. Once the man is in there, unless you can convince both chambers to remove him through impeachment, you're stuck. And I think right now the people of Europe, particularly Great Britain, France, and Germany, are stuck. I don't see how they survive this and get out of the mess they're in unless they forcibly remove these people, because there is no interest in any of these countries in going to war with Germany, or excuse me, with Russia. And the notion that you're going to pour, what is it, hundreds of billions of euros into defense and magically snap your fingers and within 12 to 18 to 24 months produce a brand new military establishment that can defeat Russia is absurd. Makes no sense at all. And we all know there is no unity of command in NATO. We have sort of herded cats in various directions as the leaders of NATO, but NATO is not an authoritarian structure. And in order to be effective militarily, it must be authoritarian. You have to have absolute unity of command.
Now, what do you say to those folks who would be alarmed by that kind of talk? And they say, wait a minute, you're talking about authoritarian command and people rising up and overturning the legally elected government.
I'm talking about rebellion. That's written into our Constitution. This was the dispute that happened in 1860-61, where people said, we have a right to secede. It's written into the Constitution. I think every human population on the planet, regardless of where they live and what nation state they reside, has, I would argue, the God-given right to rebel when they see that their rights are being utterly ignored and their country is being dragged into the abyss and destroyed. That's my point. Now, as far as what I'm trying to say about NATO, when I talk about an authoritarian structure, I'm talking about the fact that militarily, these various nations, if they tried to pool their resources and go to war, couldn't do it because there's no unity of command. There's no agreement. You put anybody in command and every single nation in NATO, all 34 members now, they all have a vote. In other words, there's no one that can stand up and say, tomorrow we execute the following operation, everyone will comply. You know, we say English and French are the two languages of command. Well, you can throw French out. Nobody speaks French except the French. Nobody wants to speak French. So that leaves you with English. How deep does English go before you have true unity of command inside the NATO forces? That's why this discussion of the NATO force is a farce. There is none. This was something that we saw during World War II. We had enormous problems with unity of command with both the British and American and Canadian forces. There were different opinions, different attitudes. Each of these various army groups and air forces was maneuvered and moved and employed in different ways at different times because of national leadership. It was very, very difficult. That didn't exist on the Soviet side at all. There were Polish divisions inside the Soviet army, but there was no Polish army, if you understand my drift. In other words, there was absolute unity of command, and that produced a very different outcome on the battlefield against the Wehrmacht than anything we could produce. And we're not in a position to enforce or impose any of these things. So the whole notion of going to war with Russia is absurd. It makes no sense. I listened to Donald Tusk, the Pole, telling everybody, well, NATO has so much more in terms of resources and money than Russia, there's no competition. Well, good luck with that. See if you can organize it, unify it, and employ it effectively. Yeah. No, you can't. That's the problem. Now, it was never a problem for NATO as long as NATO remained defensive. Because in a war in which you are defending your territory, everything changes. But we're not talking about defending Europe. We're talking about attacking Russia. That's offensive warfare. That's radically different. Putin doesn't want anything to do with that. And that's not because of weakness. It's not because the Russians can't fight. Look at how much trouble they're having with the Ukrainians. They're not having very much trouble except pushing the bodies into the mass graves that are emerging all over eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has become a graveyard. That's the tragedy in all of this. And Zelensky talks as though nothing like that has happened. He's lying. It has happened. He's destroyed that country. He's the criminal who has murdered millions of his own people in pursuit of a goal that was never attainable, the destruction of Russia. So this all has to end. I don't think President Trump, even if he understood it all, and I think he understands some of it, can end it, though. That's the problem, because he's got too many people that are insistent on keeping this going. And they are tied to the same globalists in the United States and Europe that we've been talking about. The globalists have an agenda. No borders, destroy national identity, unify everybody, erase their national language, national identity, national culture, live in the great amorphous mass of globalized world. That's failed. No one in Europe wants that. The EU is a failure because the EU that began as an economic structure became a governing structure and has tried to shove supranational law and behavior down everybody's throats. Nobody wants it. People want to live as they see fit. They want to live with other people like themselves that share their culture, their language, their way of life. We've treated that as though that's the enemy. And that is one of the key driving forces behind the war against Russia, because Russia has said, no thanks. We're not interested in that. The Hungarians have said, no thanks. The Czechs have said, no thanks now, and so have the Slovaks. I think the Serbs are saying the same thing. That's why they're being castigated every day for not doing enough to align with EU norms. Well, that's like saying, jump into the grave with the rest of us and all die here in Europe. That's absurd. But that's where we are. And I think, again, President Trump, he's not a globalist, but he's in the grip of globalists. And he's being pushed in directions that he probably would otherwise not go.
Okay.
I don't see something really dramatic coming out of Budapest.
So, yeah, and I certainly hope that's the case. But I want to go down further that path right there you meant about where maybe President Trump's being pushed in some directions. And I also simultaneously want to look at what you said about rebellions, because that's going to scare a lot of people when they talk about rebellion, because they may not like this policy or that, but it terrifies them to think about a rebellion because of where it could lead. But part of the pressure that is on to cause that, I think, is that when people think that they voted for one thing and then they're not getting it. And I want to look at that even within the administration on this whole Maduro thing in Venezuela. So we've had, there was an article out here where President Marco Rubio has been privately leading Trump's pressure campaign against Venezuela. And if that wasn't strong enough, then we had Lindsey Graham yesterday use the strongest language to date to say what he's going to claim in this clip here is what the American people want. Now, as we listen to this, I'm in my ear already hearing echoes of what you said earlier in here, that America's number one priority is not to have war with Russia, but it's not to have a war with anybody we don't need to. And yet,
Venezuela is a narco-terrorism state run by Maduro, who's had associations with Iran. He steals from his own people. It is a staging area to bring drugs into this country. And when you voted for Donald Trump, here's what you voted for. Mr. President, there's a speedboat headed to America full of drugs. What should we do? Blow it up. But we're going to the next step. We're just not going to blow up the boat. We're going after the people who load the boat in the country that provides safe haven to the narco-terrorists who run the drug cartels. Bernie's going to talk to you about Colombia, but I want to let people know the Trump doctrine is pretty simple. If you're a friend, you'll have no better friend than America. If you're an enemy to America, will be your worst nightmare. So Donald Trump is going to take Maduro down, and everybody's talked about how bad Maduro is. He's going down.
Is that what Americans voted for, though, that we want a Trump mandate to take out a regime change in Venezuela? What do you make of that?
No, that's complete and utter nonsense. In fact, if anything, people like I did and many others went into the voting booth. We voted for the man because he promised to end all these wars, get out of all these wars. If you go back to the run-up to Wilson's re-election, the banner that flew everywhere with Woodrow Wilson for Woodrow Wilson's re-election was, he kept us out of war. Yeah.
How'd that turn out?
And remember FDR, I will not send American boys to die on foreign soil. And everybody said, okay, we're for that. Remember LBJ in the run-up to Vietnam? He said, I will not send American boys to die in Vietnam to do the job that Vietnam's boys ought to do.
He said it just like that, too. He did.
Yeah. It was wonderful, wasn't it? It's all crap. Yeah. Now, this man has completely left the planet. I don't think the people of South Carolina are remotely interested in a war with Venezuela. If you want to stop the drugs, you stop them when they enter your territorial waters or they try to cross your borders. If you want the drug problem to go away, then you crack down inside the United States. You enforce federal law. We watched this massive demonstration of No King's Business, and I'm beginning to be told by people in the intelligence business that the same people that funded Antifa and the George Floyd business are now funding the No King's nonsense. What they don't understand is that this is about enforcing federal law inside the United States. That's what we need to do. We need to enforce federal law. We need to enforce state law. We have not been enforcing our laws. If you don't enforce your laws, one of two things has to happen. You go out of business. Your society collapses. Your nation dissipates, disintegrates, or you change the laws. Now, I don't think Americans voted for open borders, but they got them. And nothing has really been done to the people that did that to us. The decision to open our borders and admit millions of people about whom we knew nothing and didn't need in this country at all for any reason has never been challenged. No one has ever stood up and said, well, who are the culprits? Who are the people that did this to us? I mean, President Trump talks about the Venezuelan gang members that are here in the United States. He's 100% right. And I agree 100% with the actions taken thus far by the FBI and ICE and other agencies in the Department of Homeland Security and Justice to deal with them harshly. I'm 100% for that. But that's very different from declaring war on a foreign country whose role in all of this, frankly, in Venezuela is minuscule. I mean, anyone will tell you that. Colombia, yes. Ecuador, yes. And there's some others.
But China, India are even bigger than.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. China, are you going to solve the problem by bombing China or bombing India?
Exactly. Exactly the point.
And these nations, when you talk about India and China, there are over a billion people in these countries. Does everyone really think that the Indian government and the Chinese government are cultivating and encouraging lawlessness? No, they're not. But you're dealing with nations that are very, very large and difficult to control. You know, I would prefer they did the policing, and I would encourage them to police to the best of their ability. I don't want to police those places. I don't want to govern those places. If you go into Venezuela, you're going to have to police the place. You know, it's like I think it was the Minister of Defense from Italy who told the Supreme Commander of Allied Powers Europe back in 1998, you know, if we go into Kosovo, we will replace the Serbs. We don't want to replace the Serbs. We have enough Albanians as it is. We don't want to govern Albanians. We don't want to administer them. Well, the same thing holds true on a much larger and more dangerous scale in a place like Venezuela. And the other thing is that all these surrounding countries in Latin America, they've already been primed through various kinds of information, education, socialization to say, here we go again. The evil Yankees are back doing more dangerous things to us. I mean, it's sort of like sending the British Army to the Republic of Ireland. What a dumb idea that would be. Every Irishman would come, would rise up in rebellion, and with good reason. We're inviting stupidity and disaster.
So Doug, let me ask you, you're right, because I looked just earlier this past week. When you rank the countries of origin where drugs are entering illegally into the United States, Venezuela is number 20. So if it's that low down on the list, why are we putting so much effort in? Why is Lindsey Graham just pounding the desk talking about, let's go take him out? Why would we do something like that on someone who's that small? Is it as simple as there's oil in Venezuela?
Well, a lot of it has to do with natural resources. There's no question about it. But I think you also have a flight of fantasy on the strategic level in Washington. Just as we used to listen to people all the time say, well, we have to split Russia and China. If we can split them, then we can bring in Russia on our side against China. This is, you know, what do you think this is, 1870, 1900? It's not. It's ridiculous. It's silly nonsense. Today, economic power is far more important than military power. And what we've forgotten is that as your economic strength and productivity declines, your military power falls behind.
Right with it, yeah.
But we're not thinking in those terms. And so, you know, this is almost gunboat diplomacy in the style of Teddy Roosevelt. Well, we'll send a few gunboats and we'll send a battalion of Marines and we'll beat these people into submission. This is not going to work. It's a prescription for failure. But we have people strategically convincing themselves, well, we're flipping the board on Russia and China. They thought they were going to get into Venezuela. Well, they won't get there because we'll be there. You know, I remember Nicaragua. Nobody today remembers much about Nicaragua. Back in the 80s under Reagan, there were all sorts of people, sadly, that I knew in the United States Army. Oh, this is great. Let's go into Nicaragua. And they thought, well, this is the dream of the light infantry community. We'll send in the light divisions. That's what they're there for. And a friend of mine who will remain nameless, but who is familiar with the region and thought strategically, he said, well, if I were the Soviets, I'd send a brigade of Soviet military police to direct U.S. traffic into Nicaragua. What a catastrophe that will be. You know, we'll go there. We'll spend huge quantities of money. A lot of people will get killed. Absolutely nothing will be achieved. We've got to get back to something that we never hear anymore, which used to be popular in the medical community. It was, first, do no harm. Don't perform surgery unless it's absolutely necessary. Any surgery is by nature intrusive. As soon as it's intrusive, you risk all sorts of problems, infection, more disease, accidents. So surgery is your last option. We've made surgery on the international level our first option. And going into Venezuela is not going to fundamentally change anything strategically in our favor. Now, the people that think they're going to get control of all the oil and natural gas, and maybe they're going to march inland and get those gold mines and emerald mines, I don't know. But if you try to do that, how long is it before suddenly some of these oil derricks begin to blow up? How long before your soldiers that are policing the area in some of the areas of Caracas start dying? In other words, you're inviting disaster. This just doesn't make any sense. And how many times have we told, oh, this will be a cakewalk? You know, that's one of the reasons I talked about the generals. Beware of these generals. If you're president of the United States, beware of the general who walks in and says, come on, boss, we can do it. We've got it. We'll get the job done. Give us the mission. I mean, okay, who are these people? Well, I mentioned a couple. One was a general division commander in 1950 in Korea, and he predicted that once his troops landed in Korea, that the North Koreans would be so shocked and afraid they'd run away. Okay. Max Hastings, the historian that's written so many books on these things, said that the rout of the 24th Infantry Division in 1950 in Korea was so complete, it resembled the disintegration of the French in 1940 and the British in Singapore. So much for that. Then you had this man, Paul Harkins. He was Patton's G3 towards the end of the Second World War. He was a four-star, and he was the first commander of this military assistance command, Vietnam. And he said, "Will, we can win this war by Christmas of 1963. The South Vietnamese troops are great. They're doing a brilliant job," and so forth. Well, they had some battles with the VC, and they lost. So he reported those as victories, because that was the message his bosses in Washington wanted to hear. So I said, this really wasn't a defeat, a minor setback, but in truth, it was a victory. Have you heard that kind of logic before? You know, we left triumphant from Afghanistan. We were victorious, right? And then we have this General Donahue, who was one of the architects of the triumphal retreat from Afghanistan, who says, well, we can overrun and take Kaliningrad in what, 2 days? 24, 48 hours. I know we can do this.
It'd be easy, I think is how he put it.
Really? You know, what planet are these people on? And if you're president of the United States and you have people like that with 3 and 4 stars on their shoulders saying stupid remarks like that, you should be very afraid. Because that doesn't pass the common sense test. I think we're hearing the same crap about Venezuela. And then if you stand up and you point to the obvious, these are the reasons why you don't want to go in there and you don't want to stay. I mean, for instance, in Iraq, one of the things I've got to give people credit for in 2002, when I talked to them down in Central Command, is that the leadership in the Army, at least at the top of Central Command, understood you don't want to stay in Iraq. If you go in there, you go in, you execute the mission, put another bunch of generals in charge, and you get out. You don't stay. Now, we all know what actually happened. But people say, well, why wasn't there a plan to occupy Iraq? Because we didn't have a spare million men to send to do it. And we didn't want to do it. And we knew it was a disastrous idea. We did it. It was a disaster. My point is, President Trump needs to sit quietly in a room and think about all of this and then ask, what kinds of people am I dealing with? The people that tell me, oh, this is easy. This is a cakewalk. We can bully these people to our heart's content. And ask, is that really true? Is that really in our interest? Is that really what we need to do? I mean, you saw him in the Oval Office where he was asked point blank. We understand that President Maduro made an offer to you about a stake in the oil and gas industries in Venezuela. Was that not true? Oh, yes. Yes, he did. He offered everything. Well, why isn't that enough?
Yeah.
Well, that's not enough. What isn't enough? What do you want? You know, we're in a very dangerous position right now. I don't know where we'll be in 6 months or 12 months, but if we end up where I think we're going, he's in a lot of trouble. And he's only been president for less than a year.
That's the big issue there. It's because, like you said at the start of this, you have the piece that he's already taken full credit for, that it hasn't even been had phase two negotiated yet. Certain, it's far from certain that's even going to stay stable. You obviously have the situation of Russia, Ukraine, that you could definitely go all the way against Ukraine, probably will, given enough time. And then now this one down here, if we get into there, if all of these go bad on his watch, it's going to be pretty tough to get anything done, to even make it through 4 years and not be removed from office one way or the other. It's that serious, I think.
And we have not talked at all about the supposedly irrelevant national sovereign debt. I mean, somebody pointed out to me the other day, don't you understand that private debt is even worse than public debt? Sure. But the public debt is important because when it collapses, when it crashes, you have no government. There is no administration. Everything stops. Who's paying the police? Who pays the bureaucrats to do their jobs? In other words, the potential for apocalyptic change as a result of financial collapse is real. Nassim Taleb, who's talked about this in great detail, and many, many others, have warned this sort of thing. We need some rationality in Washington. We need to understand that the problems that we confront at home are far more serious and existential than anything happening overseas. And going somewhere else to fight another war is not a solution. You know, you would think after the No Kings demonstrations, even though I find the funding of all of this reprehensible, And I, you know, we've begun to figure out who's behind it. Nevertheless, look at that and understand the potential for unrest inside the United States. Why do you want to court this sort of thing with action overseas in other people's countries?
Right. And by the way, I want to be very clear, make sure nobody misunderstands what I was saying. I'm not saying that President Trump is worried, needs to worry about somebody else coming in and taking him from power. I'm actually talking about his own supporters, and I'm talking about by existing legislative means. There are ways to get that done. That his, if he loses the support of his own side, and he can, if they finally start paying enough of a price, and especially if you overlay on the economic issue that, that causes problems inside, there's going to be some real trouble. So I think that the wise thing to do is to recognize these things, just like you suggested. I'm a strong advocate of that. And let's change some policies while we still have a time to navigate this to avoid some of the worst outcomes.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And in this connection, I would let the Europeans stew in their own juices. And eventually the European peoples will take care of the problem. We don't need to do it.
Yeah, and but it turns out that Gary's always on top of it like he is. And you mentioned that soundbite from President Trump in the Oval Office the other day. Gary found it.
Maduro offered everything in his country, all the natural resources. He even recorded a message to you in English recently offering mediation. What could he do to stop that?
He has offered everything. He's offered everything. You're right. You know why? Because he doesn't want to fuck around with the United States.
Pretty harsh language there. But the bigger question remains, if that be true and you recognize it, then we don't need to be going down Lindsey Graham's route. That's not necessary. So we'll have to wait and see how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Well, remember, the Serbs met 90% of the conditions outlined for them by the Austrians in Vienna in 1914. It wasn't good enough. It was absolutely enough. But they rejected it, and we know the rest is history. You've got to be very careful about these kinds of things.
Indeed.
Now is well, not listen, to be incautious.
Yeah, and wise. Take the win, bottom line. Take the win when you've got it. Exactly. Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on today, as always, Doug. Very illuminating and interesting conversation today. Super appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. I appreciate it very much.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that. But also bear in mind that we are on podcast. And I know a lot of your friends prefer to get their information on podcasts. Let them know Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and they'll find us there. Let them know about that stuff. DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com for your friends who actually like the written word. Hey, folks, we are unintimidated and uncompromised, as you see in this episode here, really on graphic display. Make sure you don't keep this stuff to yourself. Share this with your friends in whatever form they like it the most so they, too, can get access to this same information. We really appreciate you, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.